Welcome back to the Ed Morrissey Show podcast. Joining us as always, the Prince of Twitter, the Regent of RedState.com, Andrew Malcolm at AH Malcolm on the Twitters is. And of course, again, RedState.com is where he writes. And Andrew, nothing happening this week. Nothing going on.
Yeah, I don't know. What the heck are we going to talk about? Yeah. I don't get it.
This has been one of the weirdest presidential campaigns I've ever experienced. You know, they're all a little different, but this has been really, really.
Yeah, I wouldn't say one of the different. I would say the most unusual. I mean, I thought it was unusual when McGovern had to replace his vice presidential partner midstream, but. But this is a, jeez, I go between tepid optimism and total despair that it will really be over.
yeah. I mean, it'll be over by the end of the week. I think at the very latest by the end of the week. I don't think that the stuff that comes in after that is going to matter materially to the outcomes in the states. It might take a day or two to get enough data out of Pennsylvania and Michigan, I think, or, you know, California and New York are going to take forever, but California and New York are pretty much irrelevant to the presidential election.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we know where those states are going to wind up.
Personal story. A long time ago, more than 40 years ago, when I asked my wife to marry me, and she was in charge of the wedding arrangements, and she picked the end of November because we were both in the news business and she knew everything would be done by then. And then I was on the Bush campaign in 99 and 2000, and it wasn't over by then.
No, that one took a while. I remember that one taking a while. It was before I was blogging, actually. And
Yeah.
I didn't start blogging until 2003. So, but I was writing writing letters into the editor about stuff, and I got a few of them published. I was making the arguments back then, even then. But look,
I've shared an anecdote from before, but the 2000 election. You may remember that I think it was Thursday before the election, I took the call. Carl Cameron called the Bush campaign and had a report or documents showing that George W. Bush had a DUI way back in the 80s. I didn't know about it, but anyway, it escalated and it turned out it was true. That was obviously before he quit drinking cold turkey. So as a result, he was leading in Maine. As a result, he lost Maine. And that was the Electoral College difference that took it to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
If he won Maine, Florida wouldn't have mattered. Yeah.
Yeah,
boy, all the little things. And I wrote about Lincoln last weekend, all the little things that happen that change big things. To me, it's fascinating. That's why history is so interesting. I wish Americans paid more attention to it.
Well, let's talk about what we've seen.
Yeah.
Far, right? I mean, the polls are basically dead even, but that there's some bias in that. And I don't necessarily mean intentional bias. I mean, just there's been a bias in national polling that's existed for quite a while that undercounts Trump's support. It's happened in the last two elections that he ran in, especially in the Rust Belt states. And I can't say for sure he's going to win this state. He's going to win this state. I'm pretty confident he's going to win Georgia, and I'm pretty confident he's going to win North Carolina, and I'm fairly confident he'll win Arizona just because of the numbers I'm seeing there. But I don't know about Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. It really could go either way. But I'm not really basing my gut instinct on the polls. I'm basing it on two other sets of data. One is early voting, right?
Yeah.
Republicans are doing a lot better on this time around, and Democrats are not doing as well as they have in the past. And that tells me that there's an enthusiasm problem on the Democrat side, and there's an enthusiasm boost on the Republican side. And the other is simply party identification. And this is, Alex Castellanos wrote about this today. We're recording this on Monday. It's going to go up on Tuesday. He wrote about this at the Daily Mail. He says, this is the one indicator that nobody's talking about. Now, nobody is an exaggeration. I've talked about it before, too. But nobody's really emphasizing this, is that you went from a D plus five electorate, according to Gallup's surveys, and they survey on this all the time, in 2020 to an R plus three, which was their final iteration, their final average iteration for this election cycle.
That's because of early voting?
No. This is even before early voting started. This is just part of Gallup's normal polling. They asked the question about party ID. And what they've said is that you've seen a shift in the electorate of 8 points in the gap. And that to me is, and it's not the only poll that's showing that, by the way. There's been other polls that show that Gallup is sort of like the gold standard of party ID measurements. And that kind of a shift, I mean, that's a significant shift. And a shift within one cycle is generally means that there's, that reflects an intent of how voters, you know, plan to vote. Because you don't register as a Republican if you're planning to vote for the Democrat, right? And vice versa.
How do they know the early voting partisan level?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And let me explain that. Some states, you have to declare your party when you register, right? And so then when you ask for a ballot or you go to early voting, they know which party it was that went to the polls. And Pennsylvania is that way. And Nevada is that way. And North Carolina is that way. So it's pretty easy. When you get the reports back, they include that in the report.
But the assumption is if you're registered Republican, you're voting Trump.
Right.
But that could overcount.
Or it might be that Democrats are switching over to Trump from Harris, too. I mean, it's an assumption, but it's basically a measure of get out the vote and organization. Right. And there's been a lot of talk about how Trump doesn't have any ground organization, but they're succeeding in getting a lot of people to the polls early, which tells me that if it's not coming from the Trump campaign, it's either coming from the RNC or one of the super PACs, which is. It doesn't matter. There's apparently some organization and it's effective, right? In states where you don't have party ID for registration, Wisconsin's one of them, right? What they look at is which counties it is that's coming, where the numbers are coming in and what the normal, breakout is for those counties. So it's a little bit more ambiguous in states that don't. Texas is the same way. Texas, you don't declare a party affiliation when you register. So when you go for a primary, you can vote in either party's primary, but you can only pick one, right?
So remember Rush was trying to get everybody to vote for Hillary.
Yeah, that was the Operation Chaos when Rush was doing that, right? So when you're looking at that, there's a couple of different ways to look at that. But basically, the early voting data that we've got this cycle is a lot better for Republicans. And I'll use Pennsylvania as an example because it's probably the most dramatic of them. In early voting, Republicans are behind by 410,000 votes. I think as of yesterday, and early voting finished yesterday. And I think that's the final number. Republicans are 410,000 votes behind Democrats in Pennsylvania, which sounds really bad, and it's not great. I mean, I'd prefer that to be a lot closer, right? But you have to compare that to 4 years ago when they were over a million ballots behind and ended up only losing the state by 81,000 votes or 82,000 votes. So Democrats are 400,000 votes shy of where they were 4 years ago in the early vote, which tells you that either their organization isn't as good or the enthusiasm isn't as good. And Republicans are up about 100,000. So it's not exactly like they're cannibalizing the election day vote either. And Republicans really turn out on election day in Pennsylvania. So those are the markers that you're looking at. But honestly, you know, this is still poking around in the dark. You can't just say, oh, this is slammed up. It's going to be a massive landslide election. It might be.
Yeah. It could be
either one, depending on how the, you know, what the numbers end up being, you know, looking like. But, you go into this and you're going, yeah, you know, you just don't know. The lay of the land has changed so much.
Yeah.
It's really difficult to tell.
Yeah. And you early voted and so did I.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. You know, and it was easy. I did in-person early voting. It's a lot easier to do it in person because it's just the same as if you do it on election day. In Texas, you have to show your ID and then you get a ballot, you fill it out and send it through the Scantron. If it works, great, keeps it and you get to go home. If it doesn't work, you get it back. You get a, you destroy that ballot and get a fresh one and try again. Some of this stuff is coming by mail. Some of it won't even have to arrive until Friday, you know, to be counted. Yeah. Strange. We should never have allowed that. And there's a court case pending in the Fifth Circuit that ruled that anything accepting ballots after Election Day is actually unconstitutional. That's going to get challenged to the Supreme Court. It's a case involving Mississippi.
That was part of the controversy in Florida.
Yeah,
which has a lot of military votes because there's no income tax. And it was my governor, Governor Mark Roscoe of Montana, who did the research and found that military votes had to be accepted if the postmark was before the election day. So it didn't have to come in by election, but it had to be postmarked.
Yeah.
That seems to make sense to me.
Yeah, but I mean, also the military ballots in individual states are probably not large enough to really impact the outcome of presidential elections either, or even Senate elections.
Well, I guess it was in Florida, but yeah, I know.
It would have been in that cycle because it was 500.
You remember that wonderful picture of that guy? With his,
oh, yeah. With his,
looking cat. For Trey.
You know, the dumb part of that is, we used that system in California for years and years. It's the first, the punch ballot was the first one I ever used. And until I moved to Minnesota, I never used anything else. And people are claiming, well, it was difficult to use it. I don't know how difficult it really was to use it. They told you, make sure that you've made the hole, right? And there was the pregnant chads where there's a dent.
Is that what that phrase meant? My pregnant God. Chad.
Yeah.
I gotta remember that.
Oh yeah, the pregnant chads. It was just means something different today, but you know, back then it was about paper ballots. Anyway, or it was about punch card ballots. Now you've got a couple of columns up today. One is it all comes down to Tuesday, but why Tuesday? And that's because a bunch of people told us, a bunch of people put it in the Constitution that it had to be the first Tuesday after the first Monday of November, which I always found to be a really interesting construct. And you address how the hell they came up with that idea, because that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, well, it's one of the many things that goes back to the Puritans, who didn't get here until December on Plymouth Rock. But, you know, you couldn't do anything on the Sabbath. And America, or the United States, for a long, long time, until the late 1800s, was basically a rural agrarian society. So Sunday was out. Monday was out because that was the travel day to town. And towns were widespread. You know, some people had to go a long way. I remember my dad, he was growing up in Canada, but in the winter, when they would go to town, they would put bricks on the wood stove and heat up the bricks and then put them in the sleigh or the wagon and put their feet on the hot bricks for the long trip into town. And Tuesday was picked because that was a voting day, and you couldn't have it on Wednesday, Ed, as you may remember from your childhood, because that was market day. when everybody was 70.
I don't recall that, but okay.
Yeah, so and November, because December and January in much of the country then was pretty rugged, pretty rough weather. The harvest was in by November, so we'll do it by then because the work in the fields is done. So they picked the November day, and that was that's what it's always been. And in fact, Ronald Reagan's second inauguration, January 20th, happened to fall on a Sunday. So they did a private swearing in the White House, and then they did the public thing on Monday, the 21st. But it was so cold that they did it inside the Capitol, which must have been crowded.
Must have been crowded.
I was at the Bush one, because the minute he took the oath, I was done. And I'm not a fan of Washington, so I had no intention of working there.
Especially in the summertime.
Yeah. So it was interesting. One voting story, which I will always remember, in I think it was 66. No, it wouldn't have been. Maybe 68. Because it was a presidential election. I voted absentee in Illinois because I was going overseas. And so I went, I had to go down to City Hall on Dearborn Street. They gave me the ballot, and the woman at the counter in City Hall said, okay, when you get done, don't seal it. And I said, okay. And I went over to the booth and filled it out. And then I looked at the envelope and it said, be sure to seal the envelope. So I did. Yep. I took it back to her and she said, you sealed the envelope. And I said, well, it says to do that. And she was very annoyed. And then I realized if it had been the wrong way vote, they would have taken it out and subbed it.
Yep.
Cook County. I mean,
Why would I be surprised that that was Cook County? I'm not surprised at all that it was Cook County.
And it was Cook County. I think 8,000 votes in Cook County came in late, and that's what elected Kennedy. And Nixon declined to challenge it. So in 60. So that was, that's a crazy place. When I went back to Illinois, I lived out in the other counties, which were basically conservative and safer voting.
Well, I live in Texas. I like the voting. But I mean, this is one of the reasons why I've done mail-in balloting before. I did it in Minnesota.
Oh, yeah. I did it in California all the time. Yeah.
It's complicated. It is complicated. And it's complicated for good reasons. I'm not saying that it's not, that it's unnecessarily complicated, but it is complicated. And so then you start worrying about, there's all these different points of failure that might enter into it. My vote won't get counted. I just find it easier to do in-person early voting. I'm not a big fan of mail-in balloting anyway. I prefer to have one election day for everybody.
Yeah.
But I don't mind in-person early voting as much because it's the same process, right? It's got all the same safeguards. To me makes a difference. So for what it's worth.
Well, did you know, I did not, until I was doing some research for the column, that it wasn't until the mid-1840s that America voted in federal elections on the same day. Until then, the states picked their own days within a six-week window. So if you think it was a long time waiting for the Bush results in 2000, you could wait. Any state could do it. Of course, there were fewer states, but within six-week window. And there was no
Congress, not the presidential election. They had to have the presidential election on the first Tuesday after the first Monday, but they didn't. It was only for the presidential election. And so they would have congressional elections sort of whenever. And Congress.
And in those days, the state legislatures picked the Senate.
Yeah. So you didn't even really have elections. It was just the state legislatures selected them for the next session. And so Congress finally did intervene in the 1840s to normalize election day for, and this was all in the, it was really interesting, this opinion from the Fifth Circuit in this case that shot down Mississippi's attempt to count votes for a full week after election day. They stayed the opinion though, because they didn't want to upset the apple cart for this particular election, but this is the last election where Mississippi is going to be allowed to do that unless the Supreme Court reverses the Fifth Circuit on this. But the guy who wrote the opinion was going through all of this, and it was fascinating, right?
Yeah.
And you know, the
do you remember who wrote that opinion?
Oh, I can't think of his, I can't think of his name, but I wrote about it on the blog.
Oh, okay.
And when the 17th Amendment passed, and I think that was 1913 or 1914.
Yeah, 13.
1913, Congress immediately created a statute to do the exact same thing that they did with the House, to force states to have the election on the same election day. But they had to do it by statute because the Constitution didn't require it. So Congress passed a statute, and the statute says it has to be on this day. And what the, you know, get into the weeds on this thing, but what the Fifth Circuit ruled in this case was that when the Constitution and Congress both acted to set a specific day, that both of them had the intent to finish the process on that date, and that ballots that came in after that would violate federal statute and the Constitution, because election days have to be consummated on election day. And consummated was a word that he used. And there's been some other precedents that have suggested that too. But I just found the whole thing, because I'm a nerd.
You know. Oh, I know. It's all very fascinating. And I did not know either that Abraham Lincoln was the very first American president to be born outside the 13 original colonies.
I didn't know that either. That's interesting. Yeah, he was born in Kentucky.
Yeah.
Born in Kentucky, and his family moved to Illinois.
What after he spent his childhood years in Indiana.
Indiana. Yes, Indiana. That's right. Yes, I recall that now. Yeah. All right. Well, I want to talk to you a little bit about, before we wrap things up, because we're actually getting pretty close to the end here. What is your sense of each campaign? Because my sense is this, is that the Harris campaign thinks they're behind, and not just that they're acting like they think they're behind so they can, they're acting like they're panicked. While the Trump campaign is acting confident, right? I mean, they're still getting the vote out. They're still telling people to go out and vote. And Donald Trump is saying, you got to go vote. You got to go vote. All that being said, Kamala Harris goes to New York to do Saturday Night Live, then is mostly off the campaign trail on Sunday. And I guess she's back in.
Yeah, she's doing three stops in Pennsylvania on Monday.
But I mean, just by the rhetoric, my sense is that they realize they're seeing something that's gotten them panicked, and they're trying their best to try to rally their own base to turn out. They're not even making a convince. They're not even trying to convince the undecideds now. This is all, you know, the dark night of fascism is upon us. Whereas Donald Trump is talking about garbage trucks and having a blast and enjoying himself and, you know, clearly feeling pretty confident. Is that your read on the situation too, or do you think that this is?
Well, yeah, I have no inside information, so this is all gut from a lot of elections, but that doesn't make me necessarily right. I don't get the panic. She's doing three in Pennsylvania today, which is a lot, but Trump has been doing, I think he's also doing three, but he's in three different states. Like 2020 and 2016, you can't outwork Trump. He was doing three and sometimes four rallies. In those days, it was all rallies in different states, busting his chops while Biden was in the basement calling it a day at 10:30 in the morning Eastern time. So I guess come down to the bottom line is that I am very cautiously optimistic, but then by dinner time, I'll switch over and be unconsolably distressed at the outcome. It goes back and forth. I hope it's not close one way or the other. I shouldn't say that about her. I mean, I can't believe American voters are so stupid. But with the media's help, Democrats have managed to, in many ways, make this a change election, which is by definition a joke.
Yeah.
Vice presidents have had trouble in the past getting elected on their own, Nixon and Gore, but George H.W. Bush got elected. But that was 88 was basically a third Reagan term, I think.
Yes, I agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah. So the George W. Bush one was close. I remember it was all by lunchtime on election day in 2004. Kerry staffers were already calling him Mr. President. And that was being reported widely. And my boss, my former boss, who was the governor of Montana, was also the chairman of the Bush campaign. And he called me. I was in Las Vegas. And he called me about lunchtime. He said, "Settle down. It's okay. Ohio will come in for us." And sure enough, the evangelicals came out in the afternoon in Ohio and turned the tide. As I recall, I could be wrong, but I don't think so. Republicans have never won a presidential election without Ohio since 1908, I believe it was. So, inconsolable.
Inconsolable is okay.
Yeah, I'm sliding that. I'm sliding that way right now, but I can be convinced the other way. But
all right.
Being inside, you don't really, it's like being in a tank or a submarine. You don't really know what's going on outside that much.
That's a good point. On that note, I'm going to read you something that's either going to cause you to feel a whole lot better about things or order some hemlock. This is in Political Playbook. I'm just going to read this off to you here. So under the headline, "Wowza," you know, in Political Playbook, you know, it's these, yeah, little clips of different things. It says there's a remarkable story in the New York Times profile of Kareem Rama by Reggie Ugwu. He's a podcaster, that details how Harris's team haggled over which topics she would talk about on Rama's Subway Takes video series and pushed the online personality to a point of discomfort that led him to entirely squash the interview that he taped with the VP. Quash, I think, is the word that they're looking for. Long story short, Rama suggested asking Harris about Gaza and was rebuffed by her team. For the surprising take she was going to share, he was told that she'd make, quote, "a stand against removing one's shoes on airplanes." When they sat down, however, Harris had surprised him with a different take. "Bacon is a spice. Rama, who is Muslim, doesn't like bacon." So he suggested that she voice a different surprising opinion. On the advice of a staffer, Harris settled on talking about pizza topping. Now, this is being passed around by Andy Kaczynski. So I had to look this up, right?
Jesus.
And two senior campaign, the New York Times says two senior campaign officials said this topic had been raised in advance. Rama and his manager dispute this about the about bacon, right? And And she says, Harris elaborates that bits of cooked bacon can be used to enhance a meal like any other seasoning. Think about it. It's pure flavor. Rama wraps the discussion 1 minute later. Well, he says with an awkward laugh, I'm 100% unsure on both of those. She switched to anchovies on pizza was the.
You know, this is so disappointing, but also insulting that we're doing this in a presidential campaign. You know, I it's a promotion for a podcast. I get it. But to play along with that.
Well, he ended up not playing along with it. He ended up not publishing her interview. He did one with Tim Walz. He said that went better. But he ended up not publishing the Harris interview. They proposed another one and he turned them down. Said, on second thought, I don't want to get involved in politics. So he might be the smartest guy in this entire entire politics, this entire cycle. On second thought, I don't really want to be involved in this. Let's just talk about
In 2000, Maureen Dowd, the columnist on the New York Times, where I used to work, her assistant called, very haughty, demanding to know what was George W. Bush's favorite movie. And I said, what does this have to do with the election? She said, well, she's doing a column about such and such. I said, no, I'm not going to ask the next president of the United States what his favorite movie is. If he wants to put it in a speech, that's fine. But I know what you would do with it. And it's not helpful. And he said, really? Do you understand who Maureen Dowd is? Yeah, I do. I was on the New York Times years before she was. He said, well, this is just unprecedented. So we're not going to include you in the article. Said, okay, gosh, I guess we'll have to live with that.
What a blow.
What a blow. God, but you get these interns and they're working for someone that's perceived as a big shot. And so they think they're an apprentice big shot, and they're not. So I have to say that was kind of nice to be able to just say, piss off. I didn't say that, but.
No, but I mean, it is kind of a, there's this meme that goes, there's this meme with this, some British, presenter. It says, oh no. Anyway.
You remember Irwin Corey, the professor who talked nonsense?
Yes.
Kamala Harris reminds me of him. And he used to start every act he started with, however. I just thought that was so brilliant. What did we miss here?
Well, I almost want to pin you down on a prediction for tonight's election, but I think I'm going to let you off the hook because it sounds like I don't want to depress you any further than it sounds like you're already depressed. So let's just cut to the jokes of the week, shall we?
Okay. I haven't been laughing much recently. Go ahead. Every time I think of one, I forget it by the time we get together.
No problem. I've got two.
Okay.
So both of them. All right. So the first one is, this guy is clearly drunk, smells like alcohol, stumbling around. He sits down in the subway next to a priest. And then the priest is kind of repelled by this guy. He stinks. He's, slurring his words. And then after a couple of minutes, he turns around to the priest, notices the priest. He goes, Father, what causes arthritis? And the priest says, Mister, it's caused by loose living, being with cheap, wicked women, too much alcohol, and a contempt for your fellow man. The drunk man says, well, I'll be damned. And he kind of falls silent for it. And then the priest, after a minute, thinks, that wasn't really charitable. It was not nice. Says, I'm sorry, my son. I didn't mean to come on so strong. How long have you had arthritis? And the drunk says, well, I don't have it, Father. I just read that the Pope has it. All right. So that's one.
Yeah, that's one of those unexpected.
Yeah, so here's another one. I hope it's equally as unexpected. These are both from jokesoftheday.net. I always like to give credit for it. So I have a neighbor. She's single. She's shapely. I'm going to come back to the word shapely in just a second. She's shapely. She's beautiful. Lives right across the street from me, right? So one day she comes home and I'm, you know, standing in my garden and she walks across the street and I, you know, was a little surprised. And she says, you know, I just got home and I have this strong urge to have a good time, get drunk, get naked and have fun. Are you doing anything? And I said, no, I'm free. And she says, good. Can you watch my dog?
I did think of one, and it's a meme from Twitter. It says, you know, I've always wanted to get naked and lie on a bare rug in front of a blazing fireplace, but I guess Cracker Barrel has a policy against that.
Got it. That's just not fair.
Actually, I misquoted. Is it? But it's better. But it turns out, Cracker Barrel has a policy against that. So
you get, way,
the, you get the picture. Yeah. Right. Anyway, that's
joke. So to really quickly, she is shapely, right? And the reason why I saw this joke, I thought, well, I got to tell the joke, is because there's a story that goes along with this. I was in, I was a junior in high school, and I was in an English class. And just to give you an idea of how pedantic I was going to turn out to be about grammar and stuff like that, we were having a discussion about adverbs. And our teacher, whose name escapes me at the moment, but she wasn't necessarily one of my favorite teachers, but she was okay. And she was insisting, she was saying, anything that ends in an L-Y is an adverb. And I said, no, that's not right. She says, no, that's it. That, you know, anything that ends in L-Y is an adverb. It takes a adjective and it turns it into an adverb. I said, no, because sometimes there's a noun that it doesn't, then becomes an adjective. She said, no, that's not right. She said, give me an example. I said, she is shapely. Said, shapely doesn't modify is, it's modifying she, so it's an adjective. She looks at me and she goes, only you, Morrissey, would come up with something
only
like that.
You are Morrissey.
Right.
Yeah.
But you're right. I guess you're right. Can we just say it usually is an adverb?
Yeah, there you go.
Usually, L-Y words are usually adverbs. I can
almost say that. Almost always.
Almost always an adverb. And then it kind of became a running gag in the class, you know, the word shape. Only you, Morrissey, would come up with.
Was the teacher shapely?
No, she was kind of skinny. She was actually a younger woman too, but and as I recall, attractive. But you know, when you're 15 years old, all your teachers look like they're, you know, the witch from Wizard of Oz. I was not hot for that particular teacher, but yeah, she was all right. She was fine. So yes.
Well, that's good to know. I wonder who she's voting for.
Well, I certainly hope that she's still around. And I mean, I don't think she'd be in her 80s, I would guess, at this point in time. So she could be still around. I'd have to look up in my yearbook who it was, but I do remember it was my junior high school English teacher. And I think that was the moment. If you're doing a movie, right? That was the moment in time where the screen freezes and underneath it says future blogger.
Yeah. Well, be careful what you're saying about people in the 80s, Morrissey.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I don't know. It's
you'll be there someday.
It's entirely possible. Maybe she's even watching this and going, I knew it was you. I don't know. All right. Well, Andrew Malcolm is the prince of Twitter, the regent of redstate.com. Go over there and read both of his columns. We didn't get to the second one today, but it is top five reasons Kamala did nothing to stop 10 million illegals. Number five is ridiculous. Go check that out. That was up over on Thursday, actually, but go check that out. And go vote, folks. Go vote. Don't rely on the polls. Don't rely on the tea leaves. Just go out and vote and take some friends with you. And we'll talk again next week, sir, when we know.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Take care. Bye, everybody.